the sense of humor that we all have, and we can develop even more in recovery. It tickles me. I did come 12,000 miles from Thailand here, but that was sort of like 3 years ago, and I'll get to that. Every time I've ever spoken in AA, it's a different story because I'm a different person every day, and I change, and that's thank God for that. But you know, one thing that, please listen up for what I'm going to say, are the similarities, not the differences, because we all have the differences, but by golly, you betcha we're all very similar. We know that. That's why we keep coming back, because that fellowship that we have, this works. So, thinking back, what got me stressed? Life got me stressed as a little kid. Stress led me to trying to figure out what's going on. Stress led me to, to booze. Booze led me to AA, and AA led me to God. And, here I am 80 years old, and sort of say, wow, that's an interesting trip. Each one of you are going to make your own, and that's, good luck. On page 164, a vision for you, it says, trudge the road of happy destiny. And I love the word trudge, because by golly, that's what we do. We trudge, but we do it. And happy destiny, that's, maybe I'll have a chance to mention that too. I apologize for sitting here. I can't trudge very well right now because, I'm getting better. About in the last year, I've had just about everything happen to me. And, every time I say that, something else happened, so what the heck. But, I broke my back in three places, and I couldn't trudge very well back in January, February. At that time, I had a food tube in my stomach because I couldn't eat, and they stuck a food tube in, so I couldn't eat. I couldn't swallow water. I couldn't eat. I had something called lymphedema, which is, still affects me. My ears get swollen from the inner ear, and my eyes water, and I can't breathe very well, and my chemo brain kicks in, and I'm not making any excuses or apologies. I'm just saying there's a lot of stuff. Oh, and if you've never heard of chemo brain, wait till you try that, and then you get something else called chemo toenail. Come on, when does this ever stop? Well, it doesn't. The older you get, the more things you can acquire. It's like merit badges, I guess. Amazing stuff. I'll show you mine anytime, it's sort of like, but we're not, we don't have to top this. Everybody here earned your seat in that chair that you're at. And therefore, I'm not going to go into a drunk log. That's pointless. So stress got me to booze. Booze got me to AA, and AA got me. So let's keep that idea going. And in the midst of all that, I'd like to say three things in terms of what we all should be doing. Who am I? Where am I going? And who goes here with me? So, in terms of how we follow a track of life, trudging the road, who am I? Where am I going? Who goes here with me? So we know the fellowship. We know this is one of the groups who goes here with me. Who goes there? We'll talk about happy destiny in a bit. Trudge the road. Who am I? This guy trudging. Okay. Where I start, doesn't matter. Okay, a good place to start. 1968, I'm in Vietnam in the war. They're shooting at me, you know, that war. And I've been in the Navy 7 years at that time, and I was an officer. And, you know, it was one of the most, well, 1968 in America was an amazing, I mean, it was a terrible year, is what it was. And in fact, we were sitting over in Vietnam wondering what was going on in America. Because Martin Luther King had been shot, you know, Bobby Kennedy was shot. I mean, we had the Pueblo being hijacked. We had Woodstock. Everything was going on, and we were in a foreign country, talking to the Vietnamese, saying, "Why are we here?" And they said, "Well, you're here, so we don't have to fight." I mean that happened to me. I mean, I in Hanoi, Hannah would come on the radio. She was like Tokyo Rose in World War II. Hanoi Hannah would tell us things, and I'd talk to the Vietnamese Navy officer and whatever. You know, it's wow. And my job there was, I was the logistics officer of three Navy bases. So we had about 500 Navy guys. And, you know, I was a Navy lieutenant junior grade at that time. And I get notification that my secret, top secret clearance is having problems because the FBI has photographs of me at the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. I mean, doesn't that happen to everybody? No, it doesn't happen to everybody. I was at Washington, D.C. I was selling my car to the Russians before I went to Vietnam. And I didn't know they were taking photographs. And I bought that car from a CIA guy, by the way. But that's one of the interesting stories. And when I was chiseling off my Department of Defense bumper sticker, the police hauled me into the Russian embassy to find out what was going on. And I said, it's the Russians' car. And I'm in Vietnam defending my country. Okay, so, you know, and I drank like a fish in Vietnam. It was very funny. You know, the officers drank whiskey and rum and bourbon and vodka, and the enlisted were smoking the hell out of the marijuana and the tie stick. That was the differentiation, and. That's what we did. I mean, no, we you know, I would not front line, yet our base was attacked during the 1068. But Vietnam, that was an amazing time, and then coming back, and no one said thank you for your service then. That they sure didn't. But you know, I'd volunteered to go to Vietnam. I did. I was on the fast track for promotion, and I had lots of stress, very good jobs, and I drank too much. And finally, at about 30 years old, it all caught up with me, and it all came down, and I ended up over here at the Navy base in Norfolk at the rehab center. And I mean, what had happened? Everything. The year before, the Navy, they didn't know I was a secret drinker. I didn't know I was a secret drinker. I mean, yes, what I did. But I had to hide that because you don't do that. Alcoholism is very bad and nasty. So you don't tell anybody. And I had been sent to the University of Virginia by the Navy for a full scholarship to get my master's in business administration. And I literally drank my way out of UVA. That was kind of amazing. I mean, how did that happen? I mean, I've been a very good student at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. How did I fail UVA? Hey, that's the power of alcohol. And I did not know, and I had to hide. weakness. I have a weakness for booze. I'll hide that. I don't dare ask for help because no one is going to give me help. They will just stop me being promoted. And that's the way the world was. This is in, in the 70s. So there I was, rehabbed, and I definitely needed it. That was where a Navy doctor said, you have an addictive personality. Addictive personality. I only smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day. I only drank on it as a warm up, 2 6 packs of beer before I got to the whiskey. I mean, what do you mean addictive personality? But I was a workaholic. Oh, what do you mean addictive personality? Why was I unbalanced? Because I was. Okay, enough on that. We all look for what is going on with the reason why am I an alcoholic? Well, hey, in our life, we have a chance to figure that out. But while we're first beginning in AA, that's the wrong question. We ask, how do I get well? And so, that's what the Navy tried to teach me at, age 30. And I decided that, alcohol was rum, whiskey, vodka, but beer and wine were beverages. So I would compromise, stay away from the hard stuff, and just do the nice beverages. And that worked for a while. I mean, it did work. And then I had a Navy boss. Oh, darn it. We went out for lunch one time. He had a gin and tonic, and I did too. And, oh my goodness, that was not good. So because one led to another. So, the Navy did try to get me rehab, and I did not go to meetings after the rehab center and all the, I tried it, and I didn't like those people in those rooms. They were not my gang. So anyway, I went on and stumbled through my Navy career, but I was not able to be promoted because the Navy knew my problem, and yet they kept giving me pretty good jobs. And ultimately, I came back here to Norfolk, Virginia for my last Navy job in 1980. I came and, I had graduated from Granby High in Norfolk, because my dad had been in the Navy, and that's where we moved. So I had been to 13 different schools in 13 years, K through 12. I mean, everybody goes through 13 schools in 13 years. That's a normal Navy family thing. I don't think it's very normal, and I think it's bad for stability. And I think it in my case, it sort of made me confused about what is real and what isn't, and it probably, made my life, Rolling Stone stuff. So here I was back. I finished up my career a pretty good job, but I was drinking more and more and more until finally I sort of was hospitalized, and I thought it was for a infected cat bite, which I did have, but the hospitalization was really a dual diagnosis, infected cat bite and alcoholism. And they didn't tell me. I thought I was fooling them. And they were doing all these things to me. And I remember over here at Portsmouth Naval Hospital, I said, why are they giving me all these different vitamins? And they had an encyclopedia there, and I would go look up the stuff, and they said, oh, you give this vitamin for people that are deficient because of alcoholism. And I said, do you think they know? I had a bottle of brandy in my overnight bag that I was gonna, I don't like to detox. You know, it's painful. I knew they were gonna make me come down, and I didn't wanna do that. And I said to myself, do you think they'll know? And they were doing blood tests on me four times a day. Do you think they'll know? No, they won't know that. I can drink it, and they won't. What? And then one day a social worker came, and she said, you know why you're here, and you know what your problem is. And I said, okay, yes, I drink a little bit too much. And she said, your blood alcohol was 0.28 at 10 o'clock Tuesday morning, and you're driven to work. What do you mean? I said, but that's more than three times over the limit. Okay, anyway, that's a lot, yeah. But that was, I was taking care of the cat bite. You know, it was infected, and you always take care of infection with alcohol. Inside's better than outside. Don't you know? Anyway, you know, the medical people do not want to talk to an alcoholic because they don't understand us, and vice versa. So anyway, the lady said, you're going to have to go to rehab again. I said, no. No, please, no. I'll do night school. I don't want to do that again. I don't like it. They're going to be mean to me. They were mean to me. You know, they got getting up at 6 in the morning and running and doing all sorts of exercises, eating correctly, and oh, they even told me I smoked too much. You know, anyway, and no booze, not even in my overnight bag. I mean, it no fun. But something must have happened because I really realized here I'm age 40. I've been in the Navy 19 years, and I would like to get my 20 years in rather than be cashiered. And so I stuck it out and you know, ultimately, you know, came out and realized that I really had a severe problem. So 40 years old, I'm 80 now, that was 40 years ago. And I haven't had a drink since. I mean, amazing. But what, you know, well, hey, for anybody, if you haven't had a midlife crisis, please have it. And don't never waste a good crisis. You know, Jim Carville tells you that too. Never, you know, they're really good. And so, I mean, I had a doozy of a midlife crisis. And, you know, I said, okay, the Navy didn't like me and I didn't do well, you know, wasn't promoted. And all my classmates, I had one classmate. He was the Navy's first four-star black admiral. I mean, Paul Reason, amazing. Roger Staubach, famous football guy, he was a classmate. Anyway, so people went on to good things, but not me. So I said, it's time to recreate my life and reinvent. And I like the word reinvent, recovery, rehabilitate, re-educate, and you know, that's kind of what I did. I was able to use my GI Bill to go and to ODU and get the master's degree that I had drunk away at UVA. And that was, you know, I thought that was going to be my step 9. Now so I'm in, you know, in recovery and I'm doing the steps. I'm not going to go into all that. You can do, you know how to do that, and you do workshops. But, you know, step 9 was a big deal for me because of who was on that list. You know, my earthly father was on there, my heavenly father was on there, and I was on there, among others. And so one of the things to make up that I Steve, resented the alcoholic Steve, and I told that Steve, he had to get that master's degree back again. that was my amends to me. I mean, that was just, you know, and I had also, I had been trying to get to be a scuba diver, and I'd given that up because you cannot dive and drink. Well, I earned that scuba credential back again and became a cave scuba diver. But, so in other words, step nine is very important. I mean, but the thing is, you know, and what I found out is my step nine for God, I ended up that's really been a lifetime thing. And that has made it really interesting for me. And that's a positive thing because, you know, I was born and raised as a Catholic, and, you know, but that's on the outside. I didn't really have it on the inside. And so when I went off and did my thing, you know, I just drifted away from all religion and just didn't worry about it. And so when I came back, you know, in 1985 time frame, you know, to do the restart, you know, I started saying, well, what, I better start figuring out, you know, what is this, you know, AA talks about spirituality, but they don't, you know, the big book, you know, it sort of finesses the whole idea about religion. So I said, all right, I've got to look into that more. But now that I'm out and under, and I'm a very academic person, I did lots of exploring. I mean, there's not a single religion that I didn't have a chance to explore and figure out what it was and what's going on, and that made it fascinating for me, and it still is. But okay, so always looking trying to get after working on my master's degree, I got my first civilian job, which is out here in Isle of Wight, in the town of Windsor, that was kind of fun for me, that's when I learned. I learned, you know, they said, you know, our Yankee. I mean, I was a Yankee because I came from Norfolk, and before Norfolk, mm-hmm. the Navy had me in New York City. But you know, I spoke unaccented English. You know, I didn't have a Southern drawl, so I was the Yankee. Oh, and I drove a red BMW, that was my reward for getting my master's degree. You gotta take care of these things. And so I would arrive in town, and the mayor would say, "Oh, there's Mr. Steve in his red Italian sports car, BMW Italian." Anyway, you know, kind of, it's Windsor, so you know, but it's interesting. I loved it. It was amazing. I did my job out there, and then after a while they said, "We want you to move out here." And I said, "I don't know." And Shazam, I came down with cancer under my tongue. Too much smoking, too much drinking, too many years from years ago. And Portsmouth did an operation on me. And for 5 years, they followed me, and fortunately, that was pre-stage one cancer, but it was, you know, it was squamous cell, which is a pretty nasty cancer. But one in three Americans will have cancer. So, I mean, my mom had lymphoma, and my dad had pancreatic cancer, and another brother, prostate cancer. So, you know, it's in our family, and it's very prevalent, you know, for Americans. Anyway, so I stumbled around. I worked in the local government for a while, and then I had to quit Windsor because of I didn't want to move, and then I had the cancer and I was scared. And so I came back to Norfolk and I said, let's see, what else do I want to do? not as a 17-year-old, I said, I want to try Navy. I want to try, you know, local government, and I want to try teaching. You know, we all have to come up with careers. I mean, supposedly. So I said, oh, I've never done, you know, I did a little bit of teaching in the Navy, and I liked it. I like teaching 30-year-olds, 35-year-old. They're very motivated, and I had even done that, you know, for a while at a Pell Grant Commonwealth College in Norfolk, and that was cool. So I said to the state of Virginia, I want to be a teacher, and they said, no, you can't be. You don't know anything about teaching. I said, well, how do I do that? And they said, you got to go get a teaching, got to go teaching stuff. So I said, the heck with you. And so I went and got a master's in education. You know, where I think, you know, some of us are just overdoers. You know, at least I am. You know, if you say I can't, you know, then I'll get out my bulldozer when all I needed was a, you know, a rake or a hoe. I mean, you know, I'm an extremist as a, you know, I recognize that as a personality. And yet, you know, hey, that came from my family. My dad was a civil engineer in the Navy, and I grew up watching him. You know, civil engineers are the CBs of the Navy. They, you know, build the runways and bulldoze and make things, and, you know, and so he was stationed in Vietnam. He'd been in World War II, and he was still active duty Vietnam. And so he came back from Vietnam, and I went to Vietnam. Well, he was promoted in Vietnam, by the way. He was a Navy Admiral. And he made Admiral when I'd been in the Navy 7 years. Dad was a very hard-driving individual, and that was, you know, my work ethic. So it was the fact that, you know, how dare I become an active alcoholic? I mean, it was like unheard of. Now, on the other hand, my last name in German means drinker. Now, come on, we have it in our family. We've just always hidden the fact that, yeah, our skeletons in the closet is we come from an alcoholic family for over many, many generations. I mean, and so it came back to me, but that's not why I drank. I drank because I needed to drink. I needed a drink to get rid of all that strife and all the stress. I mean, it finally calmed me down, and then it didn't. And we know that. We know all about that. And so, you know, what calms me down now is all the stuff that we learn in the steps, all the stuff that AA talks about, you know, and, you know, getting away from that and doing other things. So anyway, back to, you know, I went and got my education degree and became a middle school science teacher. Ooh, worst job I ever had in the world. Middle school, not nice. I mean, they're wonderful if you have to put up with them. But I, you know, they were not 30 years old, obviously. So, you know, what's wrong with those students, you know? I mean, it's sort of like, what's wrong with this teacher? I love education. I just don't like students. You know, I mean, what's wrong with that? But, you know, so it's my education, you know, and so I get smart. And anyway, so I did that for a while. That was, you know, that didn't work out. And so I finally, at the ripe old age of 52 or 3, I said, I'm not going to have any more bosses. Bosses are no good for me. And so, so I hung it up and did an awful lot of volunteer work. At that point, I had, you know, the Larchmont AA home group. I had joined them as a home group. My sobriety date is, you know, back in January of 1984. So I joined the Larchmont home group in somewhere, you know, shortly thereafter, courtesy, I mean, the Navy van took us guys there, and that's how I found Larchmont. And I mean, I'm still there. But, so anyway, I was doing a lot of volunteer work. I've been every service job, and then the one job that I ended up, I didn't like because I was the alternate, then all of a sudden it was the treasurer of all of the area. And that was, you know, that was a lot of work. And, you know, I said, we gotta hire people to start doing some of this stuff. And there was a, in fact, there, you know, there's a guy, Bill Ackerman, I don't know if that name means anything to anybody, but he's dead now, but I remember when we hired Bill in to be the intergroup or the person at the office there in Virginia Beach. So anyway, so I got involved in the steering committee and all of the AA things, and I was on the board of a Serenity House, which a rehab center in Newport News, and you know, for a while. And I was doing things for charities and whatever. And I was doing a lot of travel too, and a lot of reading, and just I was having fun. And I went one trip. I went to India with the Association for Research and Enlightenment in 1987. They're an outfit in Virginia Beach, and we met the Dalai Lama in northern India in Dharamsala, and that was absolutely amazing because, you know, it was in a room like this. There was a group of 30 travelers, the Dalai Lama, and two monks on either side of him. And it was sort of, we asked him some questions and he answered. And then there was a little bit of pause. And I remember sitting there like, you know, with this guy right here, you know. And I said, in my mind, I'm saying, I wonder what is the correct religion? And, you know, the Dalai Lama is a, you know, Tibetan Buddhist, which is small wheel versus big wheel. But anyway, so the Dalai Lama and his two monks on either side, they were sitting up, you know, up front, talking Tibetan to each other. And the Dalai Lama then looked at me and said, some people wonder about what is the right religion in the world. And so he said, you know, what you want to do is go back and follow the core values of your parents, what they taught you. And here we are in India, a Hindu country, Dalai Lama's Buddhist, and I'm with this bunch of, you know, anyway, that was remarkable. I mean, and so I stored that away. Saying, what is my issue with religion? And I said, that's what is my issue with God on my step 9? What is my issue? What is Steve's issue? All right, so anyway, I filed that away. Well, I got tired of Tidewater, you know, and I was living in Kent, and then I had gone out to Oceanfront, Virginia Beach, to try retirement out there at the Oceanfront on 87th Street near Fort Story. And I was out there for about 5 years, and I had an old building in Kent that was apartments, broken up into apartments, and so that was generating rents for me, money. So I had money, the rents, and I had my retirement money from the Navy, and I'd earned monies, you know, being a teacher in local government and other, you know, and so I did a lot of travel, and I went on a trip, just a regular tourist trip to Thailand and Singapore and Malaysia, just to see what that was, because when I was in Vietnam in 1968, I heard people talking about Thailand, but I'd never been there before. And so it was just something that I wanted to see. And I went there and I met some Americans, in Bangkok and also in a place called Pattaya. And they said, this is amazing over here. You know, Americans go to Mexico or the Virgin Islands or Costa Rica. He said, this is the best. And so, I mean, I was at that time, you know, I was in my late 50s. I was a rolling stone. I hadn't any anchor. And, you know, my parents had died. I didn't have any connections or roots. And I said, before I get old, I want a few last hurrahs. Now, I mean, I've already done enough living in terms of intermediate hurrahs. But anyway, so at age 59, I moved to Thailand. And I lived there until 3 years ago. And I was in AA. I mean, I was involved. I always get involved in service work. We ended up, New York wanted to help us, and the Thais didn't have the big book in their language. So New York went to Columbia University, got a university person, and translated the big book into High Thai. Well, the problem with Thailand and all of that is that that's not what the Thai people speak. I learned Thai when I was there, and I ended up teaching school in Thailand at a public school, teaching science of all things to middle schoolers in Thailand for free. I mean, just because I'm Steve. But anyway, and I could. And so I knew Thai. And so we ended up, we at the local AA communities, we had the big book translated into Thai. There are three levels. You know, street Thai, monk Thai, and royal Thai. So the royal Thai, the Columbia University guy, you know, so GSO New York, I mean, they tried and spent, I'm sure, lots of money that didn't help anybody. So, but we were trying to get, you know, the Thai people, because they have a terrible alcoholism problem. And, just like anybody, because, you know, and it's getting worse as their society gets developed. But, you know, so I'm trying to do stuff there and get involved in local things. And yet, you know, here I was sort of stalled out in who I was, what I was, and I went to, you know, I went to AA about once a week. And I remember in 2012, about then, I was cleaning up in my bedroom at a Thai house, and there was a crucifix just sitting on the shelf in my, you know, in the bedroom. And I had brought it back from one of my, one of my trips, it was something I had. And a voice in my, I heard this voice plainly said, it said, put me up or put me away. And I'd already knowing lots of things from spirituality, lots of things from, you know, and sort of being a lukewarm person sometimes. And so anyway, I went ahead over the head of my bed. I hung up this crucifix, and it was Saturday night. I remember going to bed, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I never in my life had such a crazy, wild dream. And it was the end of the world dream. It was apocalypse now. It was sort of like the, you know, it was the end of the world. And I mean, it was extremely disturbing. And I mean, lights were flashing in my brain. I mean, this is whatever. So, you know, and it was just, you know, not hallucination. It was an amazing dream. And at the end of it, I heard a voice said, it said, go to church. Go to church. And this was Saturday night, okay. So come on Sunday morning. We only had one Catholic church in all of Padilla. I knew where it was. I mean, I used to go there sometime. And so I went to church. And you know, went to Mass, and then the sermon that day by the Thai priest was on the end of the world. Now, I don't know about Bill Wilson's fourth dimension, and I don't know about all the other things that people talk about, but that was such an arresting day for me. I went and talked to one of my friends. He was a Unity minister, and I related the dream to him, and he said, that dream is right out of Lucy and the Fatima story. And I said, I don't know a thing about it. He said, will you bus? Because that's what happened. And I said, I don't know. But I know what I saw and what happened. So I said, obviously I better start, you know, going to church. I think I'll, you know, and it's kind of, I mean, I enjoy life now, but I mean, it's really, you know, one thing I went to, and you know, Catholics, you know, you have to go to confession. I mean, it's sort of like, yeah, you have to do step 4 and 5 every so often. It's one of those deals. I mean, and so I remember talking, and the priest said, well, don't you love God? I mean, I'm telling him about all these other things I've done. And he said, I said, well, yeah. And so anyway, I mean, I this thing trying to get back to step 9. What is this issue with booze and Steve and God? You know, I mean, I had known that, you know, Bill Wilson and Carl Jung had these, you know, letters going forth, and they, you know, it was Carl Jung that said to Wilson, you know, the AA people are spiritual underachievers. They figure that 80 proof is good enough when it's really a billion proof is what we're talking about. And I mean, I'm aware of that, and so I'm aware of this. So, you know, anyway, enough on that. And then so in 2016, I woke up one morning and my throat was swollen on the right side, enough that I was concerned. I Googled swollen throat, and it said cold or cancer. So I went into the local hospital, and he said, well, cold or cancer, I'll give you some antibiotics, and if it doesn't work, we'll come back in a week, we'll see what it is. So the antibiotics didn't work. I went in a week later, and you know, he did a biopsy on my neck, and he said, yeah, we got cancer. And he said, the problem is, that's not where the cancer is from. The cancer is from somewhere else. And so he said, we're gonna have to do a PET scan. We don't do that here in Padilla, we do that in Bangkok. So I went into Bangkok and had a PET scan. They said, yeah, you've got cancer in your larynx and trachea, and you have stage 4 cancer. This is 2016. And so they had to do a biopsy to find exactly where it was. They had to put me under and find out where they thought the spot was, and then make sure that was the cancer. And so, you know, at that time in 2016 in Bangkok, we were having the November gratitude dinner, you know, gratitude month, November. And I was in Bangkok, and I went to the gratitude dinner, and that was the day that, I mean, that I saw my oncologist, and he said, yeah, we found your cancer. We know exactly where, and we want to cut it out. And so then I scheduled, and the 6-hour operation from my right ear to my Adam's apple, 55 stitches, and they yanked out the lymph nodes and cut in the throat, and I couldn't talk for 3 months, which everybody who knows me, they would say, thank God, you know, I mean, but it was, I'm in Thailand, no talking, I'm writing notes to people who don't read English. You know, it was difficult. And so, I mean, I hired a head caregiver, you know, at least a Thai that, you know, at least could help. And I had, God bless him, a British guy from my home group in Thailand. He actually spent 7 days, you know, in a couch in the hotel room, a hospital room, and he was sort of my interpreter. Mike is 87 years old now, and he's in England. But he did that. I didn't even know him very well. He just sort of, he did that out of service. I mean, I've never met anybody that would just, for, you know, just because a fellow alcoholic has a problem, he picks up everything and goes spends a week in a hospital room. But Mike was my interpreter, and he would send emails home to America, where, you know, sister, brother, you know, whatever, family, and to keep them updated. And then the ordeal of treatment of stage 4 cancer, head and neck, squamous cell. Oh my God. So anyway, that went on, and I, you know, to date I've been 139 radiations and 16 weeks of chemo and 4 surgeries. And that you know, so that's to date. I mean, but that's, you know, in 2019, there's another one of those AA stories. 2019, I'm the secretary of the Saturday meeting at the home group, and, you know, somebody sitting there, and he said, hey, Steve, I was grumbling because I had just been told the day before that they wanted to cut out my spleen. Now, the spleen is a large organ down here in the left part of your belly, and my spleen had a, you know, a 3-inch long cancerous tumor in it, and so, anyway, they're going to cut it out. And I was moaning that fact. I don't like surgery all that much. I wonder why. But, so this guy, AA guy, said, hey, well, you go get a second opinion. And so we went to another hospital in Bangkok. There were only 2 good main ones. And I was talking to somebody, and he said, oh, listen, you've had 2 biopsies of your spleen by the best intervention radiologist in Thailand, a guy who's, God, from Yale Medical School, by the way, a Thai guy. And we've got to cut out your spleen to get at that, the tumor. We don't know what it is. And so I said, well, can't you do another biopsy? And he said, no. So I talked to that hospital's intervention radiologist. He said, there's only a 20% chance if we do biopsy that we get anything. I said, do it. Now, see, medicine in Thailand versus medicine in America, I was in the driver's seat because I had to pay up front for everything. And I was very fortunate because of my military background, I could get 75% reimbursement once I filed. And most other people over there don't get that. But I did, and when I didn't have anything serious, I was in hog heaven in terms of, you know, doing well. But you get serious things like cancer, and it becomes extremely expensive. But anyway, I was, you know, for example, you know, if you want to know, it only costs 900,000 baht to have your spleen cut out. Well, that's only $27,000. In America, it's more than 100,000. So, I mean, you know, I get to know, I used to be a purchasing person. I'd love to know all these good prices, you know. I don't know, what do you do with a spleen? I use spleen, anyway. But, in any event, I wanted to keep my spleen, and they finally found, they did the third biopsy. They got something, they saw I was my good old friend squamous cell with some other intermingled viruses in it. And they figured that they could radiate it, and they did, and I still have my spleen. After five doctors said we're gonna cut it out, one of the doctors I had to left, he was named Dr. Tiger. Dr. Tiger was a famous surgeon in Bangkok because when he was with the Thai army fighting the communist insurgents on the Malaysian border, Dr. Tiger was known to be a little bit fast with the machete. And yeah, then Dr. Tiger wanted my spleen. Anyway, he didn't get it. And so, you know, and so that was because an AA friend intervened. And at that particular time, I was on the setup committee for the Thai roundup. We have an annual Thai roundup where all the countries in Asia, and well, about 36 countries, that part of the world, they all go to Thailand to have a nice conference at a good place, good vacation. And I was holding a workshop that a friend of mine and I, and the topic of the workshop was death. I said, it's time that some AA people start talking about this subject. And I'd already been told by my oncologist that I better start, you know, counting my days because I wasn't, you know, invincible, which is interesting. But, all right, so I'm in the hospital in Bangkok. I tell the oncologist I've got to get out of the hospital to go to the conference, the workshop on death. Now, the Thais know that foreigners are a little bit strange, but, you know, he said that you want to get out of the hospital so you can go to your workshop on death. I said, yeah, that's the one, that's what I'm going to do. And at about in that same time frame, when I wasn't in the hospital, I'd gone to a Matt Talbot retreat. Now, Matt Talbot, UAA, no. It's a kind of a religious, spiritual retreat. They've got them up in Williamsburg twice a year here now. And I, you know, my Matt Talbot medallion number is 274. I think for this Matt Talbot group, 45. But, you know, so I went to one in Thailand, just a weekend, and the guy conducting it was a drunk Irish Catholic priest from Myanmar. He came out of the jungles to conduct it, and I told him a little bit of my story. He said, oh, Steve, you have to go give your death away. And I said, I know I came to the retreat for some interesting answers, but I didn't know I was going to get that one. You know, I give my death away. And I said, oh, and there's, you know, if you want to, you know, you can Google it, you can get, you know, Ruhlheiser, you know, has YouTube on it or whatever. There's, you know, literature. And so here, you know, I actually then have a mission in terms to do that. So when I came back to America, you know, still here, even in rougher shape than I was before, you know, I'm sort of realizing that, hey, I have to live life and know life and realize that, hey, at the end, you know, hey, it's all good. I mean, and that's, you know, it's, I'm one of the few people I'm aware of that can actually, you know, say I have no regrets. You know, I don't have any more secrets. You know, AA has done everything that it promised it would do. You know, AA got me back to God today. Thank you.
Steve, thank you so much.